Hi, sweet beans. Welcome back to Wild Geese. I'm your host, Anna. I'm gonna go a little off the usual routine today, and I'm gonna do a 2025 reading wrapped. I'm gonna talk about six of my favorite books that I read this year, and then I've narrowed it down to a list of eight of my favorite essays. These are not necessarily books and essays that were published this year. I just read them for the first time this year. And I just wanna preface that I am an incredibly slow reader. I think if it weren't for that, I probably would have started a BookTube account a long time ago, but I just cannot keep up with the pace that most of the book influencers that I see are keeping up with. Like, they're reading hundreds of books in a year, 20 books a month. I have never been able to do something like that. I remember being in like fourth grade and trying to read Gulliver's Travel. It was like the whole class reading one chapter on their own, but at the same time. And I remember everyone around me finishing so much faster than me and me just kind of deciding to pretend that I had read the whole chapter. I remember in elementary school feeling like I was just bad at reading. And like my favorite day of the week was the day that we went to the library, but I loved that because the librarian was like reading a book to us. So I've just decided in my adult life to embrace the fact that I'm a slow reader. I am not going to read as much as other people, and that's okay. I've read far more essays this year, but I typically only read one or two books a month. And I still have six books on my list because I really genuinely enjoyed these books. All that to say, I don't have quite a wide pool of books that I read this year to compare these books to, but I have gotten to the point where I understand when I pick up a book at the library or a bookshop, I understand usually what I'm going to enjoy and what I'm not going to enjoy. That's not 100% foolproof. I've definitely read some duds this year, but even though I don't read that many books, I typically tend to enjoy the ones that I do pick up, and I'm pretty good at giving up on books. So we're obviously going to be talking about reading today, but another great thing to take you through winter is crafting. That's why I'm happy to say that today's episode is sponsored by Craftsy. Craftsy is your online resource for all things creative. I know I've definitely been in need of a space to unplug and slow down. The holiday season can be so chaotic, but Craftsy has been a great place to do that while also making handmade gifts for my loved ones. I won't show those projects and ruin the surprise, but I definitely made use out of what I learned earlier this year in Stacey Trock's Kawaii Amigurumi class. And of course, Craftsy is always creating new classes to keep you coming back for more and help you stay inspired. So I also took Stephanie Capel's Let's Decorate Gingerbread House class, and I plan to come home for the holidays and use what I learned to get all of my family members together and make a gingerbread house. I always walk away from Craftsy feeling really satisfied that I know how to make something one of a kind with my own two hands. The first 1,000 people watching this video to use my link in the episode description will get a full year of premium membership to Craftsy for only $1.49. Offer valid for new members only. Happy crafting. I'm making this episode because it's fun for me and hopefully for you. But when it comes to taking reading recommendations from other people, I've always had a better experience when I read some part of the book before I commit to it versus just taking the recommendations that I see online or looking at book reviews. I feel like book reviews can be so personal and misleading, and half the time people are writing from a place of just like deeply misunderstanding what the author was trying to say. And I think looking at too many reviews before you commit to a book can really taint your experience with the book. Like, if I see one just scathing review of a book before I've read it, it's then hard for me to know if my experience with the book would have been different if I didn't have the context of the scathing review, you know? Also, I think there's something to be said for reading a book at the right time. Like, some of the books that I didn't like this year, and I'm not going to talk about the books that I didn't like this year because I don't find it to be interesting, but also because some of the books I didn't like this year, I don't think I didn't like them because it was bad writing or anything like that. Some of them I'm like, I think I'm just not at the right place in my life for this to really hit. And then other ones like The Wedding People, I didn't put The Wedding People on this list, but I do remember really enjoying The Wedding People. And I don't think that if I would have read it at a different time, it would have hit in the same way. Because it's basically like a story of a woman who's going through a divorce and kind of finding herself. And when I read that book, it was around the same time that I put out the Decentering Men episode. And I was just like very much in the headspace of how do we as women create a full personhood that's not so tied to our relationship with men. And that book explores those concepts through fiction. But I just know there are other times in my life when I would have read that book and been like, okay. And Sorry, I just realized that my little microphone has been banging up against the pendant this whole time, so sorry if you've been hearing that. So I want to take you through these books, tell you what they are, why I liked them, but also read some of the parts of the books that convinced me to read the books, or parts of the books that I put into my digital garden as I was reading them because they really like struck me, without spoiling anything, of course. And I realized after compiling this list that all of these books are fiction. This year, I was definitely more focused on fiction novels and literature because I felt like I was getting my fix of nonfiction through essays, podcasts, that sort of thing. And I honestly firmly believe that engaging with fiction literature is almost always more helpful than self-help books are. It's like that quote from James Baldwin where he's talking about how you think that you're so alone in the world, and then you read literature from hundreds of years ago and you realize that other people have always felt this way, and you're actually quite connected to humanity, and you don't always have to fix yourself. This is just the human condition. I do want to read more theory in 2026, though. I feel like I only read a few theory books this year, and essays just can't always quite get the same depth and scratch that itch in the same way that a book could. So, with all that being said, here's my beautiful stack of books that we're going to be pulling from today, plus one imaginary book on top that I read on an e-reader. And that book, the first book on our list, is The Book of Longings by Sue Monk Kidd. This is a historical fiction about a woman named Anna, who was a passionate writer, going against her family's wishes and the cultural expectations of the time to write narrative about neglected and silenced women. She also happens to be the fictional wife of Jesus. Before you scroll away, you do not have to be Christian to read this book. This book is not going to try to evangelize you into the Christian religion. It's not even really a religious book, in my opinion. It's more of a feminist one. Sue Monk Kidd told the story and did the research for it, not necessarily through a theological lens, but more through a historical lens. It really focuses on the humanity of these characters, and you get a glimpse of who these people might have actually been in their day-to-day lives. Something really interesting about this book was that I feel like it was the first time that I fully understood that Jesus was a political revolutionary, and it was the Roman Empire that believed him to be a threat to the state, which got him crucified. Then, of course, Christianity became absorbed into the Roman Empire, which effectively washed out so much of the political context behind the story of Jesus. The Book of Longings was the first time I felt like I saw the figure of Jesus Christ actually placed into the historical context that he would have lived in, and that was fascinating. But this book is not even about him, it's about his wife. And this quote from the first page is what made me pick up this book. I think I saw this like decontextualized on Tumblr or something and then looked up what it was. And I think if I would have heard what I just said to you before I saw this quote, I would be like, I don't know if I want to read that book. I don't know if I want to read like a fictionalized version of anything that has to do with Jesus. I don't know. But I swear I read this quote and immediately bought the book. So this is the very first page. It says, "All my life, longings lived inside me, rising up like nocturnes to wail and sing through the night. That my husband bent his heart to mine on our thin straw mat and listened was the kindness I most loved in him. What he heard was my life begging to be born." What he heard was my life begging to be born? Are you kidding me? Put it in my hands. Let me read it immediately. And I did. I read it immediately and I loved it so much. Another snippet that I put in my digital garden while I was reading this book was a part where Anna receives this incantation bowl where she can write a prayer that she can continue returning to. So she writes, "Bless the largeness inside me, no matter how I fear it. Bless my reed pens and my inks. Bless the words I write. May they be beautiful in your sight. May they be visible to eyes not yet born. When I am dust, sing these words over my bones. She was a voice." And I don't know, I think that this was the first book that I really, really loved this year. And I think it was like the perfect launching pad towards a year that has been defined by learning to follow my longings. Like 2 episodes ago, I talked all about that. And I'm still deep in the thick of learning how to do that. But it was just a beautiful fictional story of a woman who knew deep love and deep judgment and could hold both of those things and still move with like an uncompromising force towards the things that she longs for, even if it means great sacrifice, even if it means looking selfish to the people around her. Similar to The Wedding People, I read this around the time that I was making the Decentering Men episode and the Selfish Women episode. It's funny, like having these episodes throughout the year, I can kind of track the evolution of where my mind has been. That's kind of a cool gift to myself, but I digress. Loved the Book of Longings, highly recommend. And I'll just clarify, these are in order based on when I read them, not how much I liked them. I feel like it's really cool for me to look back on the books that I read and kind of trace the timeline of the year. So the next book is The 7 Year Slip by Ashley Poston. I picked this up because my roommate had it. We have this whole big bookshelf that feels like kind of a communal library in my apartment. And I don't know if I would have picked this up from a bookstore. I'm so skeptical of romance novels, and it's like very insane to look back on how my taste has evolved over the years, because I remember there was a point in my life when I wouldn't read a book unless there was romance in it. And now I definitely love a romance plot, but I feel just so, I don't know, jaded with romance novels because so many of them are just about two people being incredibly toxic. And that's just simply not romantic to me. Some part of me does kind of wish that I could turn off my critical thinking skills about this just a little bit to enjoy the romance genre like I used to. It's like either super toxic or just horribly written. And I do actually think that chemistry and banter is a hard thing to write. It's not often done in a way that's enjoyable to me, but The 7 Year Slip was an exception to this rule. This is a romance novel with a little bit of magical realism because our main character moves into her late aunt's apartment. And when she moves in, she is confronted with a man who says that he's actually living there for the summer. I think it's for the summer. It's been a while since I've read this book, but he claims that he's renting the place from her aunt while her aunt is away on vacation. And she's like, "My aunt is dead. What are you talking about? Why are you in her apartment?" And it turns out that he is 7 years in the past and she's 7 years in the future. So you've got a little bit of time traveling going on. You've got a little bit of forced proximity. So much of this was just cozy and lighthearted and fun, but it also surprised me with how it dealt with grief. And the author actually has a reader's guide in the back that I'm going to read a little bit of. She says, "Every book is a time capsule. Who I am right now, as I'm writing this 6 months before the 7 year slip finds its way onto shelves, isn't the person I'm going to be when you read this. Books are like a magical apartment in that way, capturing a singular point in time when an author writes a book that maybe someday a future you will visit and read. Who I was at the beginning of writing this book isn't the person I ended up being at the end. I look back on those earlier drafts and it does feel a little like glancing through a window back at the person you knew intimately, how they take their breakfast in their favorite restaurant spots and the worst day of their life, already knowing what'll come next. Grief is a weird thing. It can be a monster on your shoulder. It can be a friend sitting with you at the table. It can be a memory and a smell, the soft, delicate notes of floral perfume. Grief can find you in the middle of the night as you roll over to go back to sleep. It can even find you in your dreams. And grief, what it looks like, how it whispers, how you respond, is different for everyone. When I look back on the first draft of The 7 Year Slip, trying to pinpoint the exact shade of grief Clementine felt for her late aunt, I could see that I was close, but it was the sort of feeling, the sort of life experience I had to imagine." She goes on to talk about how, in the middle of writing this book, she went through a massive loss and what the experience was like to go back in and edit a book that she largely wrote before the loss happened. And I think I could feel that depth as I was reading this book. Because I'm so skeptical of romance novels, I do remember when I first started reading, kind of rolling my eyes at some things, thinking certain things were cheesy. But when I allowed myself to fully buy in, by the end of it, I was crying my eyes out. So, loved The 7 Year Slip. Okay, the next book is a total departure vibe-wise from The 7 Year Slip. It is Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. I picked this up because Rain Fisher Kwan, who I have routinely quoted on this podcast, she is a writer that I really enjoy, and she talks about Kurt Vonnegut all the time. So I was like, all right, I guess I gotta read Kurt Vonnegut. I think that's another great way to find your next read is to pay attention to what your favorite authors are reading. And this one definitely did not disappoint. This is a classic. It's kind of like a blend of science fiction, satire. There are parts that are very funny. And also it's semi-autobiographical. It is very anti-war. So love that. What's funny to me about having this on the list is that if you would have asked me a year ago if a book written about war by a white man would make it to my top, I would be like, you're insane. But it's just so undeniably well written. It deals with a main character, Billy Pilgrim, who after World War II becomes quote unquote unstuck in time. And it's basically him going through PTSD. But there's a part of this book that has stuck with me since I read it as just being absolutely masterful writing. At one point, Billy gets put into this train car filled to the brim with other people, with obviously horrible conditions, not enough room to even lie down, people getting sick and dying around him. And there's a person who Kurt Vonnegut is referring to as a hobo who keeps just saying, "You think this is bad? This ain't bad," like over and over again. It's kind of his mantra until finally it says, "On the eighth day, the 40-year-old hobo said to Billy, 'This ain't bad. I can be comfortable anywhere.' 'You can,' said Billy. 'On the ninth day, the hobo died,' so it goes. His last words were, 'You think this is bad? This ain't bad.'" And I think that in particular stuck with me because it's such a quick moment, but Kurt highlights the absolute tragedy of a survival mechanism that requires you to deny your own pain, a system, a war machine that requires that of you. And he does it without going on a moral diatribe. He bakes it into the dialogue. And that's something that I feel like is a little bit of a lost art in books, but also especially in things like movies and TV. 9 times out of 10, I feel like we are being spoon-fed the moral of the story and it's like banging you over the head with it. So I just think not only is this a great book, but I also think Kurt Vonnegut's work is just a great thing to study if you are a writer because it's just fantastic writing. The next book is Martyr by Kaveh Akbar. I picked this book honestly knowing nothing about it. I had seen it everywhere, but when I picked it up in the bookstore, I knew nothing about the story, and I just read the first page, and that was enough to sell me on it completely. So I'm just going to read the first couple sentences. It says, "Maybe it was that Cyrus had done the wrong drugs in the right order, or the right drugs in the wrong order. But when God finally spoke back to him after 27 years of silence, what Cyrus wanted more than anything else was a do-over. Clarification. Lying on his mattress that smelled like piss and Febreze, in his bedroom that smelled like piss and Febreze, Cyrus stared up at the room's single light bulb, willing it to blink again, willing God to confirm that the bulb's flicker had been a divine action and not just the old apartment's trashy wiring." So Kaveh is a poet, and I could tell from the first few sentences, to me, there's like a rhythm to it that's kind of intoxicating. This novel follows Cyrus, who is a queer Iranian-American who has lost both of his parents. His mother died when he was a baby on Iran Air Flight 655, which was a passenger plane that was shot down by a U.S. air missile during the Iran-Iraq War. He's newly sober and depressed, and he becomes kind of obsessed with this idea of martyrdom. I listened to an interview with Kaveh Akbar after reading this book because sometimes after reading a great book, I just become obsessed with the author's thought process behind it. And he said, "I wanted to give the texture of individual narrative to a collective grief," which I think just beautifully encapsulates what he did in this book. There are so many quotes from this book that I put in my digital garden and pieces that felt like they could be a poem in and of themselves. So I just want to read this little passage. It says, "The performance of certainty seemed to be at the root of so much grief. Everyone in America seems to be afraid and hurting and angry, starving for a fight they could win. And more than that, even, they seemed certain their natural state was to be happy, contented, and rich. The genesis of everyone's pain had to be external. Such was their certainty. And so legislators legislated, building border walls, barring citizens of there from entering here. The pain we feel comes from them, not ourselves," said the banners. And people cheered, certain of all the certainty. But the next day they'd wake up and find that what hurt in them still hurt. There's also a good amount of this book that grapples with ideas of grace and goodness, what it means to be good, what it means to be afforded grace, how the binary between good and evil is sort of a mythology. And I was reading this around the same time that I put out the critical thinking episode where I talked about that a lot. So again, it's just interesting to see how I don't always incorporate these things into the episodes, but it's interesting to see how the fiction that I am reading is influencing what I'm thinking about at large throughout my life. This was definitely a case of reading this book at the right time. It so seamlessly fit in with so many thoughts that I was having. Next on the list is Giovanni's Room by James Baldwin. This is one that I had on my list for a long time because I feel like I've been seeing quotes from it on Tumblr for years now. So I finally picked it up because I saw this rendition of it, which I hate that the light is like this right now. But isn't that just such a beautiful cover? But this book is about a man named David who's living in Paris. His girlfriend has just gone off to Spain to think about maybe marrying him. And during the time that she's away, David has a love affair with a man named Giovanni. You know from the beginning that the story will end in tragedy, and it's a love story that confronts shame and the complicated ways that shame can actually make you hate yourself and the people that you love. I'm just going to read a little excerpt. So it says, "Love him," says Jacques with vehemence. Love him and let him love you. Do you think anything else under heaven really matters? And how long at the best can it last? Since you are both men and still have everywhere to go. Only 5 minutes, I assure you. Only 5 minutes, and most of that in the dark. And if you think of them as dirty, then they will be dirty. They will be dirty because you will be giving nothing. You will be despising your flesh and his. But you can make your time together anything but dirty. You can give each other something which will make both of you better forever, if you will not be ashamed, if you will only not play it safe. You play it safe long enough, and you'll end up trapped in your own dirty body forever and forever and forever, like me. So anyway, I inhaled this book. It's a heavy one, but it's a fast one. And if you're wanting to get into classics, I feel like this is a pretty good entry point. I don't know. Let me know if you disagree, but I feel like this would be a good one to get you into classics. Okay, the last book on the list, arguably my favorite book of the year. I don't know. I'm reluctant to say that, but I do think this is one that I read very quickly for how long of a book it is. And it has really stuck with me as a whole since I read it. And that's The Book Thief by Marcus Suzak. I almost feel silly making a video in 2025 telling you to read The Book Thief because obviously everyone's heard of The Book Thief. This was so, so popular back when I was in, I don't know, early high school. I remember watching the movie and enjoying it, but I decided to pick this up because it's a book that's narrated by death, and the concept of that was really enthralling to me. But this book is about a little girl named Liesl who goes to live with her foster parents, Hans and Rosa Zimmermann, who are living in Nazi Germany during World War II. They take in a Jewish boy named Max and hide them in their basement. I talked a lot about this book a couple episodes back. I think it's called like Creating in the Age of Distraction, that episode. This book is absolutely devastating on so many fronts. And I don't know that I would blanket say that everyone should read this book right now because while I was reading it, I do remember having a conversation with someone. We were like at the park and I was talking to them about how anxious I was feeling. And they were like, do you think that might have something to do with the fact that you're reading a book about the Holocaust right now as ICE agents are disappearing people off the street? And I was like, maybe, but it also is such a beautiful story of human beings loving and caring for one another. At one point, Max comes up from the basement while the rest of the family is in a bomb shelter. And that's his first time in a very long time seeing the outside world outside of the basement. And when he tells Liesl that he did that after they come back from the bomb shelter, it says, Max lifted his head with great sorrow and great astonishment. There were stars, he said. They burned my eyes. I think I could talk about this book for hours and pull quotes from it for hours. It had me crying on like every other page. But also something that's very cool is that in the back of the book, there's bonus material and Marcus Suzak takes you through his writing process, which again, like I was saying a second ago, I am so enamored with hearing more about an author's writing process. But like this was him sketching out the chapters and the timeline of the book. He also talks about the drafts that he wrote before he decided that death was going to be the narrator of the book. And that's really interesting to hear about. I just found all of this to be fascinating. So if you do read the book, don't skip that part in the back because I did actually skip it the first time that I read it. And then I picked it back up to put my notes into my digital garden and realized I had skipped such a juicy part. Okay, now on to essays. This was very hard to pin down. And I feel like a lot of these are essays that I did actually quote in episodes throughout this year. And it makes sense that these are the ones that stuck because I was like in conversation with them, you know. But the first one on the list is In Defense of Pretension by Ion Artin. I'm just going to read a little quote from it, classically. It says, those who hate art and diminish it will argue in favor of the cold rationalism nonfiction and science can give us. My question is, what has science alone ever accomplished for us as people? If you remove empathy and open-mindedness, the two traits I would argue art alone can teach us, from the way medicine is practiced or policy is passed, what are we left with? It was cold, reasonable rationalism that gave us slavery and has allowed the perpetuating of genocides the world over. The removal of humanness from our thinking has resulted in the acceptance of xenophobia. It was cold, selective rationalism that allowed Europeans to experiment on African patients. Art is the curing of callousness. We have doctors who heal our bodies, psychiatrists who are tasked with healing our minds. It is information, books, paintings, films that can heal our souls. And I quoted this in the Convenience Culture is Killing Our Creative Impulses episode. And I would also recommend pairing this essay with the video essay that Dr. Fatima put out called Should Scientists and Engineers Run Society? You know, if you want to get that relational memory flowing. The second essay is by Jamila Bradley. It's called Fake Fairness is Killing Our Relationships, and it's everywhere. This essay introduces new ways of talking about dynamics that come up in our relationships, and it really changed the way that I think about relationships. I have a whole episode about this called like Rethinking Romantic Relationships or something like that. I'll have all of the episodes that I'm talking about that are related to these essays linked in the episode description along with the essay itself. The next one I have on my list is Erotic Decisions by Muse Guided. This one I feel like rocked Substack's world when it came out. At least it did for me. But here's a little part of it. It says, before language, before identity, there is yearning. The infant cries not only for sustenance, but for touch, for warmth, for presence. In that primal reaching, there is already a choice, not a rational one, but a visceral alignment with life, with connection, with being with rather than apart. And if you've been following Wild Geese for a while, you may have picked up on the fact that my mind has been kind of locked on desire and yearning and following those things. Something that Muse Guided talks about in this essay is making decisions that will align with your aliveness, even if it means offending your ego, your upbringing, your paycheck. So this essay is kind of reminding me of the Book of Longing a little bit. Again, if you want to consume any of this in relation to each other. The next one is On Agency by Henrik Carlson. I've been loving a lot of what Henrik Carlson has been putting out there lately. I like the questions that he's asking. I like the time he takes to answer those questions. I did quote this essay in my episode, How Life Changes When You Realize the Rules Are Made Up, but here's just a little excerpt. It says, agency is often framed as a hard-edged, type A, aggressive approach. But over the last year, as I've been thinking about writing this essay, I've talked to a lot of highly agentic people, and I've read biographies about and interviews with people whose agency I admire. And hard-edged does not fit what I've seen. Often, agency is almost gentle, an attunement to the world and the self, a feeling out of the details of reality and finding the path of least resistance. There is sometimes considerable force involved, hard work, but it's like the force of a river being pulled towards the sea. I think if I'm remembering correctly, reading that essay is what made me start thinking about what it means to have agency in your own life. So highly recommend. The next essay is Celine Nguyen's No One Told Me About Proust. And I think I would credit this essay as what inspired me to read more classics this year than I have since probably high school. I think it's so easy to look at classics and write them off as pretentious or boring, not worth your time, whatever. But I think especially right now with all of the slop being put out there, reading classics is such a valuable use of your time. But Celine says, snobbery didn't motivate me, passion did. I wanted to read the books that others loved. It was Lydia Davis's unyielding love for Proust that convinced me to read him. Reading In Search of Lost Time, I realized that Proust described certain experiences, being conscious, perceiving reality, observing the world, encountering other people, with a kind of trembling, vital energy I had never experienced before. Every page was rich with sensations and ideas, and every hour I spent reading the novel seemed to overflow with things to savor, because, as Proust wrote in Volume 7, Finding Time Again, an hour is not just an hour, it is a vessel full of perfumes, sounds, plans, and atmospheres. And the novel was funny, it was gossipy and scandalous and depraved. It was like reality TV, but better, because when I put the novel down, I felt that my understanding of human nature wasn't flattened out and sensationalized. Instead, I saw how complex, contradictory, and fascinating people could be. I still haven't specifically read Proust, but that sentiment stuck with me and motivated me to read more classics, and I'm very glad that I did. The next essay is called The Crane Wife by CJ Hauser. This essay follows CJ right after she calls off her engagement and goes on a scientific expedition to study whooping cranes. She's not a scientist, she's a writer, but she's trying to write a novel about biologists who are studying birds, and she realized she has no idea what that actually looks like. So this whole essay is her reflecting on her relationship that just ended and facing the disgust she had for her own desires, how it made her feel like a needy person to have them. And as she's studying the cranes, she finds a copy of The Crane Wife, which is an old story from Japanese folklore. And it says, in this story, there is a crane who tricks a man into thinking she is a woman so she can marry him. She loves him, but knows that he will not love her if she is a crane. So she spends every night plucking out all of her feathers with her beak. She hopes that he will not see what she really is, a bird who must be cared for, a bird capable of flight, a creature with creature needs. Every morning, the crane wife is exhausted, but she is a woman again. To keep becoming a woman is so much self-erasing work. She never sleeps. She plucks out all of her feathers one by one. And basically, this essay is her realizing that in her past relationship, that was the role that she was playing. I just thought this was beautiful, and it stuck with me all year. The next essay is called Democracy Was Founded on the Legal Suppression of Grief and Why Politics Without Art is Death by Ellie Robbins. And basically, she goes from talking about how in Athens, when we're like first looking at the start of democracy, there were questions of like, how do we get a whole population of people to make decisions that have moral implications together? How do we loop citizens into the process when they're largely illiterate? And they decided to do this through theater. You can see why I would be interested in this essay as a person with a drama degree. And Ellie says, we can see that in the Athenian experiment in democracy that paved the way for our current political system, art wasn't just an afterthought, a nice to have. Let's maybe throw some funding that way when we're done buying weapons. It was inextricably part of the democratic process. It was known that a city-state guided by the popular will could only hope to function if the popular will was swimming at all times in humanity's highest achievement and expression, art. But then she goes on to talk about how, in order to establish the democratic process in the first place, they outlawed lament. It says lament was a ritual carried out at funerals and following deaths by women only. It was a wild song, the voice of rending grief, often featuring ululation and other primal sounds. So while this was an incredibly cathartic ritual, it was also seen as incredibly disruptive. I just found this essay to be full of a really fascinating context to look at democracy in a different way. So again, highly recommend. And then the last one on the list is one that I read just a few days ago by Emily Rapp Black called Write for Your Life. Content warning for child loss for this one. She is writing about how the experience of giving birth to a child that was given a diagnosis that meant that he would not live very long made her the writer that she is. I'm not going to pull a quote from it because I feel like pulling out one little piece of this woman's story would almost feel like an injustice to it. But this essay was heartbreaking and hopeful and full of life all at the same time. I feel like looking back on my favorite reads of the year, some like through lines were definitely desire and grief. A lot of my favorites were really heavily grappling with grief. And I know that subject matter can freak people out. So if you decide to engage with any of this material, just take care of yourself. My taste can be kind of intense. But that was all I have for you today. And I had a lot of fun making this. If y'all want to see more like bookish reading content, I mean, obviously, in my normal episodes, I'm like pulling quotes from a bunch of essays and that type of thing. But if you want more specific, like booky content, let me know because I did have a good time making this. All right. I will see you in 2 weeks. Bye.